I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today our guest is Dr. Forrest Gahn from Brigham Young University in Rexburg, Idaho. We're time traveling this episode way back millions of years ago to a time when Idaho was covered by an ocean of water. We have a profound history of sea life recorded in our state, and it's easy to see if you know what to look for. Peter, this is going to be a fun episode.
It's always great when we talk about where oceans used to be. And people are, well, they should never be surprised anymore when you say there was an ancient ocean here.
Amazing changes that happen on our planet when you have enough time to play with.
Absolutely. I suppose we got to get into the nature news. Did you know pumpkin and squash do not like bumblebees? Wait, not one bit.
Wait a second. You got to say that again because that did not make sense.
Pumpkin and squash do not like bumblebees.
Okay, explain.
Researchers have found that pumpkin and squash pollen have chemicals, nutritional, and physical properties for the defense against bumblebees. When bumblebees ingest this pollen, their digestive tracts get distorted and damaged. The colonies fail to produce offspring because, again, it's a poor quality food, obviously, and the lifespan of bumblebees are decreased. But still, bumblebees will visit pumpkin and squash flowers. They'll feed on the nectar. But they also know that the pollen's not so good, so they will go so far as to wipe the pollen off with their legs on leaves and other bodies to remove it. It's crazy. They are aware that pumpkin and squash pollen is bad for them. Not to worry, though, if you're a pumpkin or a squash plant. There is the squash bee that absolutely subsists only on the pumpkin and the squash, so they will still get pollinated, and life will still go on for the pumpkin and the squash.
There's a world out there that I'm just not aware of.
It's way more complex than anyone ever thought.
I guess we'll look at pumpkin and squash differently now. You know, today we're going to talk about a very different environment. We're going to be in an ancient seaway. Our trivia deals with that. What ancient environment is preserved on Idaho's tallest peak, Mount Bora? If you climb all the way to the top of that, as many of you probably have or should sometime in your life, what kind of ancient environment is actually preserved up there? When we come back from the break, we'll meet our guest, and at the end of the show, you'll find out.
This is KISU-FM Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg. Also available on your Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
I want to welcome Dr. Forrest Gahn. He's a professor at BYU Idaho. Thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Thanks for the invitation.
So you are a professor at BYU. Tell us what you study.
My degrees are in geology, but I primarily focus on marine biology in the fossil record. So I study fossils from the oceans and the history of those fossils through time as preserved in rocks.
Idaho is pretty darn far from the ocean today.
It is now, yes. So
make that connection for us.
Sure. So throughout geologic history, sea level has risen and fallen. It can rise and fall by about as much as 600 feet. In the past, Idaho, before the mountains were here, before the Snake River Plain was present and the Yellowstone hotspot was active, Idaho was covered by warm, shallow tropical seas.
So does that mean Idaho was actually lower than it is now?
Yes. Essentially, again, before the mountains were formed, it was a marine floor, in some cases a marine basin. And from around 600 million years ago to perhaps about 165 million years ago in the Jurassic, Idaho has really spent more of its time under the ocean surface than above it.
Yeah, so that's a remarkable thing to contemplate. Most of Idaho's time in that time span has been underwater. We're talking hundreds of millions of years ago, and those are big, big numbers, I think, for anyone to try to comprehend. When was the last time that we have evidence for ocean water being in the Idaho region?
The last significant seaway that covered Idaho was around 165 million years ago in the middle part of the Jurassic. You move into the Cretaceous, the age of dinosaurs, and you kind of get some estuary-type environments in some areas. But by about 165 million years ago or so, Idaho is, you know, since that time, Idaho has mostly been dry land. Prior to that, it was, again, dominated by shallow ocean environments.
So what attracted you into marine paleontology in the first place? How did you get into this area of study?
I grew up in the Midwest, in southeast Iowa. In fact, I grew up in Burlington, Iowa, which is sometimes considered the crinoid capital. In that one town, there are over 350 species of marine animals preserved called crinoids, which are animals related to starfish and sea urchins. And there I really became very interested in the history of life in deep time. And I had an opportunity in high school to take a geology course and go out and collect fossils. And it really just fascinated me and held on and has really never let go. So just as Idaho was once covered by ancient seas, most of this continent was, including my hometown in southeast Iowa.
I have to do a shout out to Iowa because I grew up in northwest Iowa.
Fantastic.
On the opposite corner of Iowa. Yep.
Yeah, you grew up in ancient marine sediments too.
Mm-hmm.
The fossils that you were looking at in the Midwest, were these just... I don't think of mountains in those areas. And
right.
So how are you finding those fossils in that kind of a setting?
Yeah, we don't have mountains back in the Midwest, but we have creeks and we have local quarries and the bluffs along the Mississippi River, all exposed rocks. And it is in those places where we can find little hints into the history of the past, unlike the mountains out here that are just in your face. We just have little hints of rocks exposed. But they do provide us with opportunities to look into the past and to collect some pretty remarkable fossils.
What kind of rocks are you looking for in order to find a record of ancient sea life?
Mostly sedimentary rocks, especially limestone, but also sometimes things like shale and even occasionally sandstone can preserve fossils that I'm interested in. But it's mostly limestone.
Are there any signs as you're moving around the environment that will trigger, hey, there's some potential fossils over here?
You look for material that is a little more articulated, or that is to say, you know, put together. A lot of times in these marine environments, you think of a seashell or you think of a starfish, and when that animal dies, if it's not buried quickly, it can rapidly fall apart into individual small pieces. And so you're especially looking for evidence of things like ancient storm events. If you think of an ancient tropical storm or hurricane that would have buried a lot of organisms rapidly and all at once, oftentimes those can preserve some pretty remarkable remains of organic life. Again, if you think of a big hurricane, it can dump inches or feet of sediment at once, just covering an ocean bottom assemblage. And then over time, those sediments will harden into rock. And over more time, those rocks will become exposed and weather away, exposing the beautiful fossils that are still articulated or complete after all of those millions of years.
Let's dig into this one group that you've talked about a little bit already, the crinoids, because unless you are tuned in, I guess, to various sea life that has lived over time, you probably are not aware of what a crinoid is. Can you paint a picture for us? What
you
that
bet.
Looks like?
So most people, if they encounter fossil crinoids, they will discover them as little tiny discs that almost look like Cheerios preserved in limestone. So if you're in Idaho and you're hiking some of the beautiful high mountain country and you look down and you see what appears to be Cheerios in the rocks, those are very likely to be the broken up bits and pieces of crinoids. And crinoids are a group of animals that look a little bit like plants. They're related to starfish and sea urchins. Then they are actually still alive in the oceans today. So some of the oldest crinoids that we actually see, or the earliest crinoids that we see in the history of the group, are from rocks that we find in southeast Idaho in the Bear River Range, in fact, in Ordovician-aged rocks that are around 475 million years old. And some of the best fossil crinoids in Idaho are actually, again, in the high mountain areas of the state, and are from a later period called the Mississippian, which is about 350 million years old. And again, these are animals related to starfish and sea urchins. Functionally, they're a little bit like an upside down starfish on a stick. you know, they have a mouth, they have, you know, tentacle-like feeding appendages that they can use to capture plankton out of the water column. And they were really abundant in the past. They're not nearly as abundant today. But in some places in Idaho, if you go, for example, to the Lemhi Range or the Beaverhead Mountains, you can find, you know, 1,000-foot thicknesses of rock that are made almost 95% of bits and pieces of crinoids that lived and died and generated limestone.
Yeah, that's fascinating, the amount of production that these animals, by virtue of the body parts that we find of them recorded in the rock, can be really amazing.
Yeah, and I think that's an important thing to note, too. So crinoids, like all of their relatives, the starfish and sea urchins, make their bodies out of little tiny plates of calcite. And it is calcite that creates limestone. And so as these animals live and die and pieces of their bodies accumulate, what they're essentially doing is producing the limestone that, again, makes up a lot of the high country of eastern Idaho.
In addition to crinoids living on the seafloor and, you know, extending up off the seafloor on their stalk with their sort of starfishy-like top part, those would be living on the seafloor. What else would have been living in those oceans during this ancient time period?
So we find evidence of sea urchins and starfish and a group of arthropods that kind of look like horseshoe crabs but are distantly related to them, the trilobites. We also find a group of organisms called brachiopods, which are essentially seashells. They look a little bit like clams, but they're, again, not very closely related to them. We would have also found a lot of coral. So Idaho, during much of its history, the history that we discussed before, from around 600 million years ago to around 165 million years ago, was situated very close to the equator in subtropical to tropical waters. And in those subtropical waters, Idaho was host to many marine tropical animals, including coral reefs, you know, those that you might imagine today, and all of the organisms that are living around those coral reefs, in addition to various groups of fishes that were swimming above and around the reefs, and again, a lot of the organisms that were living down on the bottom of the seafloor. So if you were to go scuba diving, or have gone scuba diving in Idaho, you know, 350 million years ago, you would have seen a rich diversity of life as you might see in the Bahamas today. And in a similar environment also. Idaho is very much more like the Bahamas 350 million years ago than it is right now. Instead of fields of potatoes, it would have been, you know, fields of crinoids and other marine animals.
You got to tell me how it is you go about finding the various fossil animals that you're talking about. We've got corals, we've got brachiopods, crinoids, we even have fish swimming. I can maybe imagine swimming out in this ancient world. Maybe it would almost look like today if I was, you know, scuba diving in the Bahamas or something like that. But now fast forward to modern day Idaho, and we've got mountains and we're very, very far from an ocean. How is it that you make these observations? Where do you go to find these things? What are you looking for? And tell us a little bit sort of the day in the life of a field paleontologist looking for invertebrates?
That's a great question. One of the first things that I do when I'm trying to find fossils is I'll look at a geologic map of Idaho. And there are several great geologic maps available of the state. One of the things that I'm looking for are rocks of the right type. So on that geologic map, I'm interested in finding just those rocks that represent ancient marine deposits. Trying to find rocks of the right type, like limestones or shales, as mentioned before, but also of the right age. They need to be in that 600 million year to about 165 million year window. In particular, I'm mostly interested in rocks that are around 475 million years old, and also those that are around 350 million years old, because it is rocks of those ages that really best preserve the animals that I'm interested in, the crinoids. And once I find out where the right rocks are, I'll then look at something like Google Earth, and I'll look in the outcrop area for the rocks of that right type and age, and I'll see where those rocks are best exposed. And then once I find, using Google Earth, an area that seems interesting, then I'll just tie my boots real tight and throw in a pack and do what I can to get to that spot. And in Idaho, most of the lower elevations are blanketed in volcanic rocks. So in order to get at the fossils in the rocks that I'm interested in, it often does require a many-mile hike. I've walked up to 12 miles in a single day to get to a high peak where I might find rocks that I'm interested in. In fact, I've spent up to 8 days just in the backcountry camping and exploring, oftentimes with students, looking for fossils that we're interested in. And in the state, we've actually found many new species of marine invertebrate rocks. I think unjustifiably in some ways, the marine fossil record of Idaho, the marine paleontology of Idaho, has been ignored to some extent in favor of more of the vertebrate paleontology of the state. A lot of times when people think about paleontologists, they think of dinosaurs. I'm one of those paleontologists that doesn't study dinosaurs, but I study those marine rocks. But again, within the state, we have probably found on the order of 45 to 50 new species of marine invertebrates, most of which have yet to be described. But once we get out there and find the specimens, we very carefully record where we found them using GPS and record that information in our field notebooks, use a Sharpie to record a waypoint or a catalog number on the rock before we bring it down. And then once we get it back to campus, we use various methods to extract those fossils from the rocks in order that they might be described for publication.
Has there ever been a location that you were surprised at finding fossils in?
Yes. In the southeast corner of the state, in the Bear River Range, I had one of the most memorable days searching for fossils in my entire life. I was down there with a colleague from University of Texas at Austin and a couple of other individuals. And we were looking at some rocks that are known for their paucity of fossils. In fact, it's some of the most difficult rock to look at because you essentially walk for days and look at mostly blank rock. But we found this one interval on this mountainside in this otherwise blank rock that preserved just this wonderful window into the past, again, on the order of probably at this one locality, close to 25 new species that were just very well preserved. Some of those I actually brought with me today. It's too bad I can't share them with you over the radio.
That's fantastic.
But it was a day I'll never forget. I remember it with very, very fond memories. And I think it'll be hard to ever really match that experience in the rocks of the state that are of that age. In fact, those rocks represent some of the oldest marine sedimentary rocks that preserve things like starfish and crinoids and so forth. Some of the oldest starfish in the world are from that locality in the Bear River Range, some of which we just recently described in a publication.
And to know that it's in our backyard, as you mentioned before, you know, this state has been overlooked for this kind of discovery of fossil type. In part, I know this because, you know, the population is relatively small in Idaho, and the number of researchers who have really tromped over the various mountain ranges in Idaho haven't really been tuned in to the invertebrate fossil, the marine fossil record, but it's waiting out there to be discovered.
Yeah, and part of that, again, is just numbers of people, but it's also fairly difficult work. It's you know, working at the highest elevations in Idaho and in the surrounding states. Again, we've spent hours and days and weeks above 10,500 feet exploring Idaho's geology. Because again, you've got to get above that veneer of volcanic rock into those really well-exposed mountaintops to really get the best look at Idaho's ancient oceans.
Well, it sounds like your profession, when especially when you're doing the field work, includes a fair bit of hiking, camping, being out in nature 100% of the time, and being trying to tune yourself into what the rocks are telling you effectively. Tell us about that. How does it feel to be out in the field doing that kind of work?
It's unparalleled, really. I mean, I can think of nothing I'd rather be doing than being in the rocks, wherever they may be, really, looking for and thinking about the history of the ocean's past. And another fun little aspect of this is, you know, I grew up in the Midwest, where you could basically drive into a quarry and look for fossils. It's certainly much more technical out here in the West, in the mountains of Idaho. But when I go up into the mountains of Idaho, it's not uncommon for me to find some of the exact same species in Idaho that were part of the same seaway that extended all the way into Iowa. And so in high school, I collected certain species of crinoids, some of which I can also find in Idaho. So there's that nostalgia also. I mean, even though I'm away from the Midwest and up here in the mountains of Idaho, in many ways it feels like home to me. It's the same ancient seaway, and it's the same ancient species that were part of this grand ocean that covered most of the continent in the past, millions of years ago.
That's great. You kind of put things into two very different scales. You've got these little tiny crinoids, and then you're combining this ocean that was over North America into this massive, basically, body of water.
Yeah, and by finding some of the same species in Iowa and Idaho, you kind of piece together the history of connectivity of the ocean and the ocean basins. You realize that there were marine connections from the Midwest through the West and elsewhere also, and it's just another piece of the puzzle that's really exciting to put together.
What are some of the bigger questions that you're able to address with the kind of research that you're doing?
That's also a great question. So even though I love searching for individual specimens, what I'm really mostly interested in are whole community level questions. My emphasis is really on paleoecology. So I study the interactions between organisms and their environments, and organisms and other organisms, and how those interactions have influenced their evolution, but also their ecology over time. So for example, one of the things that I'm very interested in is the history of predator-prey interactions. And if you think of a starfish, if a starfish loses its arm, it's able to regenerate or regrow that arm. Their crinoid cousins are able to do the same. So if crinoids lose arms, they're able to regenerate those arms. And we can study patterns in regenerated arms to elucidate the history of predator-prey interactions on crinoids in the ancient past. And again, there were fishes and other groups of organisms living in the oceans that very likely attacked crinoids, just as fishes will do to crinoids in modern in ocean environments. And again, we can use things like patterns of regeneration to study the intensity and changes in the intensity of predator-prey interactions in the oceans over time.
So can you see evidence for crinoids, who are a prey species, they're being eaten by something else, can you see them changing from an evolutionary slow standpoint, can you see them change over time to somehow prevent being preyed upon?
Yeah, so around the time we see an especially significant increase in regeneration frequency in crinoids, around 380 million years ago in the Devonian, we also see that crinoids are adapting by generating thicker skeletons and also developing a lot of spines on their skeletons, kind of some of the of nature's earliest fish hooks, if you will, that they're developing these defenses against their predators. We often refer to this as evolutionary escalation or an evolutionary arms race, where a predator will cause an adaptation in a group of prey, and then the predator will continue to have to adapt to become a more effective predator to overcome those defenses in the prey. And so we can certainly see these trends and these patterns in the fossil record. And many of my publications have addressed that very issue, not only predator-prey interactions, but also parasite-host interactions. There's a whole group of snails that used to live in Idaho's ancient seas. And we have found specimens of this in the state, snails that would attach to actually crinoid anal vents, anal openings, and they would sit over that opening and feed from the food that the crinoids would gather. And that wasn't so good for the crinoids. they would basically, you know, perch on top of the crinoid, and they would stick their little feeding organs into the crinoid and mine the food, essentially, that the crinoids were gathering. And as a consequence, crinoids that are infested by these parasites would show lower growth rates, diminished growth rates, reduced body sizes because of the influence of parasitism. And this is something also that we've been able to identify and document in the rocks of the ancient seas of North America, including Idaho.
That's great that these stories and these histories exist for us to uncover now, so many hundreds of millions of years later. But, you know, it's through diligent work and collecting and lots of lugging heavy rocks back to the lab.
Yeah, and we can thank the ancient hurricanes and ancient tropical storms that once, you know, moved through Idaho, that preserved these sea bottoms with such high fidelity that we can sample some surfaces in the high mountains of the state, just as we would do a survey in a modern marine setting. There's just, you know, really great preservation of some of the hard part, you know, marine organisms.
That's wonderful. And you teased us a little bit about today's trivia question. I want to get back to it. Maybe our listeners will get a sense of what the answer might already be. But our trivia question at the start of the day is, what ancient environment is preserved on Mount Bora, which of course is Idaho's tallest peak at 12,066 or something like that, feet above sea level. Tell us what ancient environment preserved up there.
The top of Mount Bora, the rocks at the top of Mount Bora represent an ancient tropical ocean. And that is witnessed or evidenced by the fossils that you may find there. It's sort of the icing on the cake. If you've ever had the chance to hike Mount Bora, if you get up there, you'll be rewarded by some beautiful fossils from the ancient seas of Idaho.
Well, right on. We'd like to thank Dr. Forrest Gahn for visiting with us today. And to learn more about Idaho's marine paleontology, please contact Dr. Gahn through byui.edu.
The Nature of Idaho is produced at KISU-FM Studios at Idaho State University in Pocatello. Technical assistance and production by Jamin Anderson and Caitlin Hart. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org. Find The Nature of Idaho weekly podcast on iTunes or Google Play Music. For more information, click on the Idaho logo at KISU.org. Or send email to noidkisu@isu.edu.